The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the fifth night. There are four streams, and the first one is with Kevin MacDonald. Now, I don't think Kevin needs any introduction, but I will say that he and I have met once in, I think it was Lithuania, but that was only once and only briefly. So Kevin has, people have asked me to invite Kevin on Millennial several times over the years, and indeed he would have been a natural choice, but for one reason or another it never happened. And but this year I certainly wanted to invite him due to obvious geopolitical events. So Kevin, thank you for agreeing to appear. I should say we don't have webcams on, but that's just it's audio only, and that's really what matters. So Kevin, welcome to Millennial.
Glad to be here, Millennial.
Excellent.
And, I do remember getting together one time, and we certainly share a lot of beliefs and everything.
Yeah. I remember. I think it was Lithuania. It might not have been. It was an era where I was going to a lot of conferences, so I get them mixed up now. But would you like to introduce yourself briefly, just so that people know, just in case anyone doesn't know who you are, and tell people your background?
Sure, I'm an academic, a retired academic. I'm very old now, and I used to teach psychology, evolutionary psychology, at California State University, Long Beach. I've been retired about 7 years. I've written a bunch of books. The reason a lot of people know me is because of my book, The Culture of Critique. And I have two other books on Judaism. And I've written a lot of other things. I edit The Accidental Observer and The Accidental Quarterly, which both deal with Jewish issues, but not exclusively. We deal with white issues, with the fate of Europe and the West. And I've also written a book on the West and, you know, where we came from, where we're going, called Individualism in the Western Liberal Tradition. That was published in 2019. Culture Critique was published in 1998, so it's been around a while, but people still seem interested. And I'm trying to write a revision of that, a revised 25-year anniversary edition, but I'm not going to make it by the end of this year, so it'll probably be next year, and I'm hoping to do that.
Excellent. Well, I mean, the exact year, I always get hung up about deadlines and so on, and it really doesn't matter. What matters is that the work is done. I would say. But I think before we begin this, I should, for the sake of my own legal standing, I should, because you're in America, obviously, I'm in Britain. There are hate speech laws and very stringent, energetic protection of certain groups in Britain. So I'll begin with a disclaimer that I'm not necessarily endorsing anything that you're saying, or vice versa, for that matter. And also, I think it's important to say that, I mean, this is an obvious thing, but I guess it does need to be said, and it should be said, that we're not talking about every Jew. we're not talking about the guy who has a small shop somewhere on the street, or some anonymous neighbor or the guy that you bump into at the bus stop. Obviously, it's not every Jew or Najalt. it's more specific than that. We're talking about a particular elite. So, Kevin, the issue that really prompted me to invite you on this year is obviously the Gaza conflict. I don't know if that's quite the correct term for it, but because I think it's spreading wider than that. But Israel invading Gaza, prompted by the Hamas attack on Israel on the 7th of October. Do you have anything to say about that initial Hamas attack and Israel's response to it? Just the military side of it first. I know that's not your wheelhouse, but you might have something to say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe that there was an attack. I think it's questionable as to what Israel knew about it. They were certainly warned about it. But in any case, it was an attack, and a lot of hostages were taken. There were a lot of deaths. And it wasn't pleasant. It wasn't pretty. The problem has been that Israel has then attempted to seize the moral high ground here. But if you look at the Israeli apologists in this country and elsewhere that I've seen, they don't talk about the context of what was going on in Gaza. I mean, there has been a blockade since 2006, I believe, when Hamas took over. That means that they monitor everything that goes in there, and they prevent a lot of things from going in there. So they're basically living at a subsistence level. They can't, leave. I think Israel would love them to leave somewhere. They would like to expel them, but certainly other countries don't simply want to take them in. And it's an intractable kind of problem. And Israel simply saying, "Well, they attacked us." Okay, yeah, they did. But what would you do after all this time? It's been occupied since long before that. It's a festering situation. It's been much worse there than in the West Bank. Although the West Bank, you're seeing a lot of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. Israel abandoned the Gaza. They took over. I forget what year that was, but anyway, they decided to, not to keep, their troops there. So they left, but then they instituted this embargo, and Hamas is militant, but it should be remembered that Netanyahu and the Israeli governments have encouraged Hamas because they wanted a separate base of Palestinian power outside of the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority, they didn't want one Palestinian entity to be ruling things. So, there's an article in the New York Times yesterday sort of shocked me that Israel's been sending money to Hamas, piles of money, to keep them going. And Netanyahu is instrumental in funding Hamas and establishing it as a counterweight to the Palestinian Authority. And these guys are radical. And I think you and I would be radical too if you'd had that situation in the Gaza all this time with really no hope. I mean, it's not like the conditions were getting better. It was not that there was any promise that they would have a two-state solution or a one-state, or that Gaza itself would become a country. Nothing like that. There were no carrots for the stick. So it was a hopeless situation. And the governments in Israel have gotten more and more extreme. On the right, they're people like Meir Kahane, who is a Jewish nationalist. He had all these racialist ideas about the Jewish state. People that follow him are in charge, but also the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox people who, follow people like Schneerson, the Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, people like that. they are extreme in their hatred of the Palestinians. They're extreme in their desire to dominate that area. And as I said before, they would like to expel every last Palestinian, every last one. And, you know,
well, that leads me to the what you said earlier, that they want to clear them out. And several high senior figures in the Israeli government have said this, that they literally want to, well, clear out the Palestinians from from that area and rehome them, or just get rid of them, just send them anywhere, send them to Egypt, send them to Jordan, send them to Europe, send them to America. And as you say, their reason for this is, well, they attacked us. Well, yeah, let's say that they did attack you. I'm sure that they did. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that you get to ethnically cleanse them. I mean, that's to remove them from their ancient homeland. That's just a crazy. Well, they attacked you. Okay, deal with that. But that doesn't mean genocide.
And the fact is this
dispossession.
Yeah, this ethnic cleansing has been going on long before the attack on the West Bank. The New York Times, which is, if anything, biased towards Israel in general, they had an article dish the other day that. I was talking about how basically the Israelis seem to want to round up all to get the West Bank Palestinians out of the countryside into the cities like Bethlehem, Ramallah, and the other Palestinian cities on the West Bank. They want the countryside for themselves, and so you know since couple decades now, they've built all these separate roads over there. They've got all these walls separating off where the Palestinians are and where the Israelis are. So it's an apartheid state, and it's engaged in ethnic cleansing. They're pushing people off the land. I mean, this article in the New York Times is just amazing how these Israeli settlers would go out. They would rip up, they've destroyed the homes of the Palestinians. They've been there forever.
I remember seeing some footage where they destroyed a whole set, a forest, I don't know what the term is, for like an olive grove. These old trees.
Olive groves, yeah. In this article, they're talking to someone whose entire village was destroyed, and then the Israelis came back and said, if you build anything there, anything, even put up a tarpaulin to keep out of the rain, it will be a violation because you need a permit for that. And they don't approve any permits for building on the West Bank by the Palestinians. Nothing is approved. 1%, I guess. So, they're oppressed over there. And since the attack on October 7th, there's been a lot more violence over there. Just yesterday, like 10 people were killed. They've invaded these refugee camps with the soldiers. They've arrested, thousands of people. And,
I find it very difficult to believe that you need to bomb and destroy an entire building in order to, because there might be some Hamas militants in there. Even if the building is a hospital, you've just got to destroy it, because after all, there might be a bunker underneath it with Hamas militants. That I've never heard of that kind of tactic in warfare before. It's just so over the top and gratuitous.
It's amazing. Every time Israel kills somebody or does something to civilians, they say, well, they were acting as human shields or something like that. On the West Bank, really don't talk about what the Israelis have done. Again, the Israeli, the pro-Jewish apologists in this country, Israel, they ignore, 50 years of occupation and what that has done. It's not been an easy occupation. What's going on in Gaza right now is, of course, the worst it's ever been. And, even Biden the other day, now this is a mistake on his part, but he said that they were bombing them indiscriminately Yeah, it's obvious they're bombing him indiscriminately. They've got 18,000, over 18,000 dead, most of them women and children. And you just can't explain that any other way. And so after Biden said that, his underlings were walking it back. Oh, you know, he doesn't really mean that, you know, that kind of thing. It's true. It's obvious to anyone in the entire world. But the reality is that the Israel will not change their behavior because of world opinion. They never have. I mean, you know, for the last 50 years, their settlements have been condemned. And for the last 50 years, the United States government has complained about the settlements. And nothing has happened. All they've done is increase the aid to Israel. Whether it's financial aid is around $4 billion a year, whether it's diplomatic aid, and now U.S. government wants $14 billion, which would basically pay for Israel's war. And, you know, it would happen. It's not that significant numbers of Congress people would not vote for it. They would happily vote for it, except the Republicans are now trying to tie that to border security, that they have to do something about the open borders. The Biden administration had let in millions. Like, well, some people think as many as 15 million of will have come in, well, just walked over the border, and then they give them identification, they give them money, they give them places to live, they transport them all over the country. It's an invasion that the Biden administration has unleashed. But they absolutely love Israel, but they're not willing to sacrifice the open borders. They want that very badly because it's in the interest of the Democrat Party. They feel that these people will eventually vote for them. They're non-white, and so they want to be able to swamp the white population. They already have it basically done, because most school children in this country are now non-white. But they haven't accomplished the task yet, and so they want to hurry it up as much as possible so it can't be undone. And they're well on the way to doing it. But that is now, their program to do that is now standing in the way of aid for Israel and Ukraine. That's the big deal, where you know, they wanted to fund Ukraine. They want to give them $61 billion to keep the war going. But again, Republicans won't vote for it unless they do something about the border.
Yeah. Well, that gets us onto the broader issues. I'd like to stick with the Gaza conflict for now. So one thing that's put out there that's said, and I don't know if it's true or not, I'm not being dismissive of it, is that the Israeli people, like the public, aren't as gung-ho or aggressive or pro-war or, you know, racistly anti-Palestinian as Netanyahu is. Yeah. And also that his own government are less gung-ho than he is. In other words, that there's a certain theory that Netanyahu is... there's an expression for this, like acting, he's a bit of a loose cannon and has really engineered this, forced Israel into this war, and is doing things that most Israelis don't approve of. I wouldn't be surprised if that's true, but what would be your take on that?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, they've established this unity government, where all the political parties are now in this government. As I said before, it's the most extreme government in Israel's history. And, of course, there is dissent. Excuse me. There are a lot of, you know, sort of liberal Jews in Israel. There's a huge conflict during the fall, prior to the invasion, where these liberal Jews wanted to change what happened was that Netanyahu's government proposed having the parliament, Knesset, be able to override the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court was much more liberal than the Netanyahu government. It's sort of the opposite of what's going on in this country, where the liberals often want to They want to pack the Supreme Court. They want to, you know, prevent the conservatives from having a majority, which they have now. Got a basically a 6-3 majority, and this is anathema to the left. And so there are various schemes to change that. Well, in Israel, it's the opposite, where they're too liberal. And the Knesset, they want to be able to override the Supreme Court with the Knesset. So that was a big deal. There were a lot of demonstrations in this country, demonstrations in Israel, throughout the country. But all that stopped with October 7. I think there's more unity in Israel about this war than one might think. And it's certainly the same in this country, where there are certainly groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, the website Mondo Weiss, and I'm sure there are others that are protesting this, are very upset about what the government is doing over there. But, you know, they don't have the power. The power is with the Israel lobby. The power is with the media, especially the conservative media. The conservative media in America is dominated by pro-Israel attitudes, partly because of this Christian Zionism. A significant part of the Republican base in America are these Christian Zionists who think that if Israel wins, if they survive and prosper and dominate all their enemies, that will speed up the coming of Jesus. And that's a whole long story there. But
yeah.
That's the story in America, where conservatives are definitely in favor of Israel. On the left, though, I mean, there's a huge conflict on the left between these sort of leftist universal values of peace, love, and all that versus what's going on in Israel. It's so obvious, anybody can see it. And so there's a significant number of Democrats who have reservations now about Israel.
Yeah, well, here is a thing that happened, I think, on the 29th of November. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism.
Right.
And it was 412 yes and only one no.
Exactly.
I mean, that is astonishing.
It's astonishing.
A ratio like that. I don't know how anyone, and you don't even need to have any prior beliefs on these matters. How can you look at that and not think that something is up?
It's an expression of Jewish power. I mean, that's what it really is. And every representative there knows that if they start really criticizing Israel, if they don't vote for that kind of thing, they will have an awful lot of money going against them in the next election. These people have to be have elections every 2 years. And they know that, their political life is going to be very short indeed if they don't vote for things like this. And, you know, it used to be that pro-Israel people, the whole Israel lab, they would say, well, of course you can criticize Israel without being an anti-Semite. You can say things about Israel that don't make you an anti-Semite, even if you're critical of Israel and the government. Now, they don't allow that anymore.
Well, demonstrably. I mean,
yes.
This resolution here equates anti-Zionism, which I'm certain would include criticism of Israel and the Israeli government, with anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
I think this is an ambiguity that they've wanted to clear up they've wanted to eliminate for a long time, because it's annoying. It's inconvenient for them to have to say, okay, this person isn't anti-Semitic, but okay, well, that means that they've got some credibility then. They've got to take them seriously. Whereas if they can just dismiss them as anti-Semitic, then that's it done.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of the people voting present there, the only one who voted present, is a Palestinian herself.
Yeah, what does that mean, present? I didn't mention that because I don't know what it means.
Well, they're not voting yes or no. They're just saying present.
Right.
It's a non-committal. But, you know, she is Palestinian, her origins, immigrant background. And she has been very critical of Israel. So it's astonishing, though, that only one person voted against him. This is a Republican, Thomas Massie. Interesting guy. He was interviewed by Tucker Carlson recently. I'm not even sure they talked about that. But, you know, he's definitely a different sort of guy from most Republicans. Most Republicans fall in line completely on this kind of stuff. The first act that the new Speaker of the House did was to have this kind of vote on Israel and to promote the funding for Israel. But again, that has fallen by the wayside because the Democrats insist on an open border. And that's not going to fly with the Republicans.
Here's one thing that I wanted to ask you about. Somebody put it to me, a sort of centrist guy, put it to me that it's really the case that left-wing Jews are anti-Zionist and right-wing Jews are pro-Zionist. So the divide is really between Gentiles. It's between the left and the right. And the left are, well, woke, as it were, and the right are up for homeland and ethnic supremacism, as in Zionism. And I'm not saying that that is the same thing. I'm just saying that that's the way this guy saw it. So would you say that that divide is, that's an accurate way to characterize the situation, that right-wing Jews are Zionist, left-wing Jews are anti-Zionist?
No, I think that's way overgeneralized. I think most liberal, most Jews in America are liberal. They're 70-some% vote for the Democratic Party pretty much no matter what. And they're on the left. But, you know, they are also very Jewish. They have strong Jewish identities. They fund the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has been pro-Israel and still is. And again, a lot of that is simply Jewish money, Jewish power. There's a long list of American politicians who have, lost their position because they have not done what the Israel lobby has said, going way back in the 1980s. So, you know, it's a phenomenon of American politics that they really have an awful lot of power.
It's certainly true in American politics, but it's also true to a lesser extent. Well, let's say it's very true in British politics as well. Look what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. And his only crime, as far as I could see, was not being sufficiently pro-Zionist.
Yeah.
So for that, he was denounced as anti-Semitic. Not anti-Zionist, but anti-Semitic.
I realize. And we have this writer, Tobias Langdon, on Occidental Observer, who's written about British politics and where the money comes from. And both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have these Friends of Israel organizations, and they are dominated by Jews, and the financial contributions to British politics come very strongly again from British Jews. So it's the same story really everywhere in the West.
Earlier today, I heard a story from, I don't know if I should name the country or the person, but it was a Western European country. And there was this political party, and it had a guy in it who was in charge of rooting out anti-Semitism in the party.
Yeah.
And but he had a Turkish wife. And he was reaching out to Palestinian organizations, trying to broker trying to get them to be less anti-Semitic and to broker some sort of agreement between them and the Jewish group in his party. Well, in response, his career and reputation were destroyed. He was smeared as an anti-Semite.
Oh, yeah.
It was astonishing. The story was incredible. And he was a slave. He was a slave of this cause. He devoted his life to rooting out anti-Semitism. He himself was a Gentile, I should say, and he'd done his work diligently, but because he was seen as too friendly to the other side, to the Palestinians, he was smeared. And quite relentlessly and thoroughly, and also threatened, intimidated. All of this was done simply because he wasn't sufficiently on their side.
Wow.
I mean, even though his life was dedicated to serving their interests. Yeah. I mean, it's just astounding.
Yeah, you know, once you get on the wrong side, I tell you, forget about it.
Well, indeed.
Pretty tough.
Yeah. Okay, well, one other thing I wanted to bring in briefly was because obviously you talk a lot about Jewish power, concentrations of that in America and around the world. But one problem that people often say is affecting the Jewish community, the diaspora, is marrying out of. Yeah. The Jewish diaspora. So a Jewish, obviously you've got the matrilineal thing coming in here, but let's say a Jewish man marries a Gentile woman. The point is, this seems to happen an awful lot. I did read a percentage once, a long time ago now, but I can't remember what it was, but it was surprisingly high in America that Jews marry non-Jews. Do you think that this is a problem? Do you think it is a phenomenon? Do you think they're worried about it? Do you think it's having effects, etc.?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, I think most Jews, as I say, are you know, secular at this point. There's been a decline in religious observance, but. At the same time, and when so you have this odd marriage, and it's over 50% now, I understand it. But, you know, it's separate from whether you identify as a Jew. I mean, marriage is one thing, and it's I think that it is true that in the long run, the children and grandchildren will be less Jewish and may completely not identify with Judaism. But there are a lot of examples of Jews who are intermarried, but still retain a strong Jewish identity. And again, you know, you wonder when you try to think about Jewish ethnocentrism. Certainly, you know, if you look at the traditional Jewish community, it's hard not to think that they're extremely ethnocentric. You know, living in these closed off communities and you know, really not wanting to socialize or do anything with non-Jews, you know, since the Enlightenment, it's been much more complex. And so you do see certainly more interaction and Jews are accepted as sort of fellow citizens in a lot of areas. And they certainly are in the United States and throughout the West, pretty much.
Fellow whites.
Yeah. But when you can really see it coming to the surface when you have this kind of situation, when Jews feel threatened. An awful lot of, I've found a lot of rabbis and people like that saying, I've never been so Jewish as when there was a war with Israel was involved in. And so I saw that today. I posted that in Occidental Observer. And that people were testifying how, they didn't attend religious services. They didn't think much about it. But then after the Gaza attack, they really, you know, started being concerned about Israel and, you know, donating money and that sort of thing. So there's much more unanimity among Jews when you have a crisis. And this ethnic identity surfaces far more than before.
There was a phenomenon of early on in the conflict of men flying over to Israel to join the IDF.
Yes.
I don't know how much that was artificial, but I definitely saw quite a few tweets about that and photos of planes full of young men on the way over to Israel.
Yeah, there's a Orthodox Jews at the counter of El Al in New York paying for tickets to anybody who was in the reserves in Israel, something like that. Probably veterans, people who had served in the military. And he was paying for all the tickets. He spent $250,000 on the spot to do that.
I have to say that this seems like a healthy group to me in that way. This is exactly how people should be and how, you should care about your people. You should care about your homeland.
Yes.
So it's absolutely right. We see this behavior. We see this kind of thing, and we note it, but we comment on it, as we're doing right now. But it just occurs to me, this is exactly what I would want for my own people. I despair because they don't have this sort of collectivism. They don't have this sort of identity. They don't get called back to Britain when Britain is in trouble. They don't pay each other's plane fares in order to help them to fight for the homeland and fight for the group. Yeah. We're so individualistic that we're just scattered.
And that's the other thing about the West. Western European culture is unique. My book from 2019, I tried to talk about individualism, the origins of individualism in the West and the history of it. And what I think is going to happen in the future. But individualism is the opposite of this ethnocentric phenomenon that we see in the Jews. And you don't have this group identity. And it's hard to get people to have a group identity. We've been talking on Occidental Observer, Occidental Quarterly, and all that, and a lot of other people have, that you just can't get people concerned about the eclipse of white America. And they don't care. And they don't care about their children. They don't care about their grandchildren. We already see all this discrimination against white people. They don't care. They want to be good people. Our very important aspect of Western culture is what I call moral communities, where we want to be good people. We want to fit into the moral zeitgeist. And right now, the moral zeitgeist is determined by the big media and the big political culture, the academic culture, and that's all on the left. It's really anti-white at this point.
Oh, it's explicitly anti-white at this point. I think it's about being a good person in the here and now. And so you don't care about your grandchildren. You also don't care about your great-great-grandparents.
Especially your boys.
There's no sense of continuity. There's no sense that I am part of a story. It's just I'm here, right here and now, a biological unit, being good. And I can understand that for what it's worth. I just don't think it's worth as much as seeing yourself as part of a story.
Right, and especially women. Women don't identify with the group as much, but our women, they want to be seen as good people. This phenomenon of virtue signaling that everybody talks about, that's really what it is, where you want to be seen as a good person, and you sort of knuckle under to whatever they say about white people, and it doesn't matter that you hear that, white people are just being discriminated against when they're applying to college. It doesn't matter, or that being discriminated against in job applications and all these other groups are being favored. It doesn't matter. They feel guilty about slavery that happened, 150 years ago in America. The British wiped it out a long time before that. So,
that guilt shows that they do identify with their group in some way. This is the sick part of it all, that they do understand that they are connected to the man who, whipped some black slave 300 years ago. So they do feel white. They do feel part of a collective, but only when it's bad.
Yeah, that's where we have to feel a threat, because you really don't know what the future will be like when whites are a minority in the Western countries, which they are slated to do. I mean, it's almost inevitable now without a political cataclysm where people are deported or, you know, walled off like the Israelis do to the Palestinians, denied the vote and everything. That's the only thing you can do now. Obviously people aren't willing to even think about that. We are, if you think about, say, what happened in the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution, I don't think anybody could predict it, how violent it would be. You know, how, you know, Jews were a dominant elite in the Soviet Union for the first, two or three decades. And, during that time, 20 million Russians died. The Orthodox churches were burned to the ground and all that. And we can't, I don't think we can envision what might happen when whites lose power. And that is the problem. And yet you cannot get whites to be interested in that.
Mm. It does seem to be a problem, but it's also worth saying that our lack of collectivism, I mean, I'm sure that we always had individualism, especially the Anglo segment among us. I'm sure that individualism, the outlier, the entrepreneur, the eccentric, this kind of stuff must have always been there.
Yeah.
And in that sense, we've always been individualistic. We've always valued liberty and so on.
Right.
But I think we did also have much more collect. I mean, I've spoken to old people, in our movement, old, like people in their 70s and 80s, and people who can remember life in the 50s.
Yeah.
And they've said, people were naturally much more, everyone was just much more, what would now be termed racist. You know, they just didn't like foreigners. They just didn't like outsiders, like ethnic, racial outsiders.
That's right.
And that was just how we were. So we were much more collectivist than we are now. So I guess the issue really is time and time and time and time again, when you see an organization whose job it is to demonize, discourage, and punish collectivism in white people, it does seem to have Jewish funding or often be headed by a Jewish person.
Yes, and in my book, The Culture Critique, I talk about the Frankfurt School, especially in this one. The Frankfurt School decided, they started out as Orthodox Marxists. It's all about class struggle and all that. But then they realized, especially after the rise of National Socialism in Germany in World War II, that Marxism was not the answer. It was really ethnicity. The idea that you had this homogeneous German population that had banded together in a very ethnocentric, nationalistic kind of way, and they didn't like Jews. And so the problem was white ethnocentrism. And so ever since World War II, a huge part of Jewish activism has been to condemn white ethnocentrism and condemn any white person who's proud of his race and his culture and that sort of thing. Now, you can't express that without being a pariah. And you're right. Even when I was a child, I did feel a sense of being part of this Western culture that was continuous, going back to the Greeks and Romans and the tribes of Europe. That is lost now, where people don't think that. But, individualism was there. That's what produced the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is very individualistic. Individual freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of association. You look at the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution. It's all about individual rights because, they saw Europe as oppressive and dominated by, arbitrary kings, and they didn't have it.
The thing is that individualism does not have to mean deracination. You can be an individual and very much value your liberty and so on, and still see yourself as part of a community, So yeah, and every, that's the thing. Every individual, no matter how wildly eccentric he is part of a community, unless he's literally living out in the on his own somewhere. Everyone is part of a community. And
it is possible. And
deracination does not necessarily follow from, like, literally just not caring about your kind is not necessary in order to be a free individual.
Absolutely, right. And I mean, I feel I'm an individualist in many ways. I mean, I don't necessarily follow the crowd in points of view and everything. But I also have a sense of my people and my race. But I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I see ethnic conflict as being part of human history. And I see it as something that's endemic. And these people have the idea they can somehow escape history by being nice people. And you can't.
Well, and the rules-based economy, the rules-based society, where everyone, it doesn't matter what you are, where you came from, where your parents, grandparents came from, just as long as you conform to these laws, then we can all get along. And I think that that's just unraveling and destined to unravel. It's just completely unworkable because it's a fantasy. But one thing you said leads us really into the main thing that I wanted to talk about, or that I wanted you to talk about. You said that ever since World War II, Jewish organizations have been afraid of something similar happening again. So German collectivism, the white majority in their host society collectivizing against them, noticing that, seeing them as an outside group and ejecting it. So ever since then, they've been afraid of that happening. So they've discouraged and demonized collectivism. And so then that brings us to this Gaza conflict, because what is that but ethnic collectivism? What is that but, and really ethnic supremacism in this case, because they're literally saying, the Palestinians just shouldn't be in Palestine. They just shouldn't be there anymore. Early on in the conflict, there were tweets from a lot of Jewish individuals that were literally genocidal, like literally saying we wipe them off the face of the
earth. Oh yeah, I've seen those. Yeah,
it was if you want to see ethnic identitarianism or racism or supremacy, you look at those tweets from Jews talking about the Palestinians. I mean, it was brutal, vicious. So this brings us to this big contradiction. They discourage ethnic collectivism in us and yet seem to have it in absolute spades for themselves. So it's obviously hypocritical. Kevin MacDonald, over to you.
An amazing phenomenon, but I've seen those kind of statements, and you would think that I think it has definitely resulted in conflicts among white liberals, because there's such an obvious conflict with their principles, and white people tend to be principled people, so it's a problem for them, psychologically. It produces cognitive dissonance. But at the same time, what I noticed, though, is most of them will not say anything about it. They just ignore the problem as if it doesn't happen, because they know it's conflicting with their principles, but they just don't want to offend anyone. And they know that if they go out there and start criticizing the Jews, there's going to be problems, big problems. So
the blatant hypocrisy just is allowed to continue because there's no way to even draw attention to it without setting yourself up for crucifixion.
Yeah, you're going to, and the Jews have shown over and over again that people who really take active stances against them, they will suffer for it one way or another. They'll try to get you fired from your job or... at the very least, they'll try to get you socially ostracized, And with the attitudes out there on the left, a lot of families have been broken apart, including my family. I mean, it's hard to take, but if you have a sense of collective identity, identify with your people, your culture, and all of that, and you worry about what's going to happen in the future when whites are a minority, well, that's the kind of thing that white liberals absolutely hate, and they will not talk to you anymore. They will, throw you out of their lives, and it's sad, but that's the reality of it.
And this is largely an environment shaped by Jewish lobbying, Jewish organizations
who've
implanted this idea into the culture that to identify with your group, especially if you're white and especially if it's in a positive way, is evil.
Yeah, it's evil.
This is
really not to just say you're intellectually mistaken or wrong. You've got the wrong philosophy. You're an evil person. You're a bad person. And that's what is really difficult to overcome. We want to be good people. We want to be part of a moral community. But that's the way it is now. We want to be on the side of the elite media. We want to be on the side of the smart people and academics. And that's the problem now.
And I think that the open contradiction with the Gaza conflict that relating to this, that we are not allowed, we are supposed to think that collectivism is evil, yet Netanyahu is doing something explicitly, like a violent, brutal act, a war, and he's doing it explicitly in the name of collectivist ends. That is an obvious contradiction. So the only rational response, if we're to be consistent, is to say to Netanyahu, this is completely outrageous. You're not just being a racist. You're not just microaggressing the Palestinians or something like that. You're not just showing Israeli privilege. You're killing them. That's really, really bad. You're killing them by the thousand. That would be the consistent way to react to what's happened here.
Yeah,
it'd be laughable, but it would be consistent.
It would.
So this gets us to the main thing. How do you think this recent conflict has affected Jewish prestige around the world, especially in America? Their ability to act as there are two parts to this. The moral superiority that they so often preach, that they so often pretend to have, and also their ability to sell that everyone should be an individual.
Could you repeat that again?
Well, how do you think this conflict has affected the prestige of Jewish organizations around the world, the Gaza conflict?
Well, I see almost unanimous support for Israel. And I think that there's a strong tendency to decontextualize this. The only important thing is that October 7th, some Jews died, and some of them in awful ways. That's the end of the story. Simon Shamas, a well-known British columnist in The Guardian, I think, in one of those papers, was saying yesterday, don't give me anything context about, it's not about context. It's about what happened, Jews getting killed. That's what happened. And you're not supposed to think about anything else. And Jewish organizations are like that. I mean, the ADL, the most important, most powerful organization in this country, Jewish organization, totally on the side of Israel, they've had a huge increase in donations and all that. Again, when you have a crisis like this for Israel, there's a huge upsurge in support for Israel and the Jewish state and everything Jewish. People start going back to the synagogue and the whole thing. An amazing phenomenon.
Yeah, I think at first the Jewish element is much more present in American media than it is in British media. That's an important distinction to make here.
Yeah.
They certainly are present in British media, but it's not the type of saturation that is in the American media. And I think at first, everyone was on the side of, like in the media, they were all on the side of the Israelis when the attack first happened, and especially the way that the attack was described in the initial, the first few days. It seemed completely brutal, and Hamas were, you know, raping and mutilating, maiming, killing, slaughtering people at this party, this rave. And then the story about the 40 beheaded babies came out, and people being put into ovens, this sort of thing. Very extreme stories. And I think at first the media was completely on the side of the Israelis, completely sympathetic. But then they launched their counter-offensive, and that was brutal. And the media in Britain, I think, struggled to continue sympathizing with them. I think that's now, it's kind of reverted. So the line has been established that Israel is justified in doing what it's doing. But it's not as strong, it's not as powerful as it was in the immediate aftermath of it.
No, I don't think it is. It's not as strong as it has been, because it's sort of grossly disproportionate and indiscriminate, and, you know, huge numbers of civilians, children. And if you watch Al Jazeera, you see all these video from hospitals where they're dragging people in, bleeding, and rows of dead people and everything. It's really something to see. And I do think the administration, you know, the Biden administration is trying to, you know, claim that they're criticizing Israel. And they are. They're trying to get Israel to, you know, be less, you know, brutal. But Israel just has a long history of ignoring that kind of thing with no consequences. They've been condemning settlements for over 50 years. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing to think about is the history of, even in the Old Testament, what the prophets talked about, the Jewish war. There are all these quotes from the Old Testament where basically the way you wage war is to wipe them out, man, woman, child, animals, everything. And, you know, so it's total war. And that's what we're in here. Again, the Orthodox are in charge over there. The Orthodox run the place, and they are gung-ho about all this. And it's going to get – it could well get worse. I mean, I think they announced today that they thought they'd be in there for several more months dealing with this. Well, that just means more and more casualties. And it's already ruined, and – desperate shortages of everything, can't go, you know, they told them, well, go south. And now that they've destroyed the north, or something like 80% of the buildings are destroyed, they're going to the south, and they're going to do the same thing there. It's going to be completely leveled.
Yeah, I also heard that they were blocking the exits for the Palestinians. I mean, I don't know if this is true. And I don't want to say something that's inaccurate about the events. But I heard that the Israelis told the Palestinians use this route out to leave, and then they blocked it so that the Palestinians were then trapped there where something dreadful could happen to them. One other thing I would say about the response in the West and in Britain is that I think the media has been to-ing and fro-ing a bit, but politicians have been almost unanimous in their support of Israel. And that has been very noticeable. And across all the political parties. I mean, there's just no question. There's just no debate, really, about whether Israel is in the right here. The politicians are fervent about it. That has been astonishing to see. Kevin McDonald's dropped out. Let's see what's happened. Hold on a second. These technical things happen with a live stream. There are always these problems. Let's see. Sorry about this, everyone. Hello. Welcome back, Kevin.
I'm sorry. I clicked the wrong button.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. So I was in the middle of saying that in Britain, the media was a bit to-ing and fro-ing about the conflict and Israel's behaviour, but politicians were fervent in support of it. And that was a very noticeable thing over the last few months. But the thing is, regardless of the media and regardless of what the politicians are saying, I think the public in Britain, and maybe this is different in America, I don't think that they are in support of what Israel's done. And someone in the live chat said, this is the first time that Israel lost the propaganda war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you say about that? Like the public's feelings about it. Obviously, you're not a pollster, but what's your intuition on this?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the case in America. But again, people, especially these liberals, and there are an awful lot of white liberals, they just don't talk about it much. You know, I think it really conflicts with their values. I mean, white liberals are prone to, you know, if you see them on Twitter, they're talking about the Holocaust and they just love Jewish stuff and everything. And now they see this and they just don't want to, you know, they don't want to criticize.
Yeah.
But so they don't say anything. But then I think a lot of other people are, you know, sort of waking up that Jews have an awful lot of power, and there's a gap between what the Jews advocate in this country, like open immigration and all these liberal things, and versus what is going on in Israel. And I think a lot of Americans don't even know about the situation on the West Bank or in Gaza. They don't know about – you'd ask the average American how many – years has Israel occupied that area. They have no idea. There's no information out there. In fact, I was a reasonably educated guy, PhD and everything. I didn't really understand the situation in Israel until much later, like in the 1970s, I started to be interested in the fact that there were these settlements and everything, but most Americans never knew about that, vast majority. And I only woke up very gradually to the whole issue of Jewish activism and that sort of thing and what they wanted in our country.
I think I heard you saying somewhere that when you began to write The Culture of Critique, you didn't even have a position on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's incredible. But yeah, we do learn and wake up to these things at different times. I think that the key point that I wanted to make here was that I think that the public, as that commenter said, they've lost the propaganda war, which is amazing given the hold that they have on the media and especially on politics. So
I would like to see polls in this country about all that, honest polls.
So would I, but especially among the young, because I think that there's a certain, like the boomer generation, they are, historically, they're very...
I think young people are more skeptical about
it. Definitely. So would you say that this is a pivotal moment? I mean, that was, when I contacted you about this, I said that this seems like a pivotal moment in... with this kind of thing in the West. Would you like to comment on that just to close off?
Comment on what going on in the West?
Well, whether this is a pivotal moment in the arc of Jewish power around the West.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't see it declining, certainly. You saw that vote in the House of Representatives. 4-4, 12-2, basically. The arc of it was that there were Jewish communities in America, and you know they weren't very powerful. But there's a huge increase in Jewish immigration in 19 between 1880 and 1920. And then in 1924, you had the Immigration Act of 1924 basically said that the United States should be a European country. And so we should cut off immigration from Eastern Europe. We should be importing people from Scandinavia, Western Europe, but not Eastern Europe. And the real reason, as Jews are well aware, was that we were importing so many Jews from Eastern Europe. And the Jews at that time were often radical, politically radical. This is right after the Bolshevik Revolution. They were Zionist, Orthodox, and all that. And, of course, that changed when they were in America. But Jews gradually got more. They lost the vote in 1924. They didn't have enough power in America at that time to get their agenda through. But that changed gradually, but especially after World War II. Even during the 1930s, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. There was a famous radio broadcaster named Father Charles Coughlin. He was a priest, a Catholic priest, and he would go off on the Jews, bankers and all that. And there's Henry Ford in the 1920s, published the Dearborn Independent, talking about Jewish corruption and their influence on, especially on trying to get rid of Christianity from the public square. But by the after World War II, especially, it all changed. Before World War II, a lot of Americans did not want to enter that war. But then when you had Pearl Harbor and then Hitler declaring war on America, well, then that changed. And then we defeated, Hitler and the National Socialism. So everything changed after that. And anti-Semitism dwindled just for a fringe phenomenon. And then in the 1960s, Jewish power increased dramatically. And that's my generation. I was in college in the 1960s, and I was there at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, very Jewish university, a lot of people from New York and other East Coast cities who were Jewish, and they were on the left. Their parents had been what we call red diaper babies. They had grown up, in these Jewish communist or left-leaning households often went to what they call these red diaper summer camps, and they were totally on the left, and they led these student movements, and they it was a really an expression of Jewish power coming of age. And of course they already had a huge position in the media with the big all three broadcast networks were owned by Jews, all the Hollywood studios, big newspapers like the New York Times were owned by Jews. And so the media was more even than now explicitly dominated by Jewish ownership and then content. And it's, increased, I think, in terms of support in general for Jewish attitudes, positions, support for the Holocaust education, support for Israel, for legislation and related to Israel. Now, one of the big things was the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, where they tried to convince companies that they shouldn't deal with Israel. Well, the Jewish activists got going and said, if you do that, we're going to set up laws so that we will, you'll be prosecuted, even though that it's a free speech right and should be a clear First Amendment violation. But anyway, it's been increasing, and I don't know when it's going to really end. So far, they seem to have negotiated this war in terms of political power. But, as you say, young people are more and more skeptical. There's a lot of anti-Israel, I should say, activism on campus, which, of course, is labeled anti-Semitism. Jewish students have sometimes been harassed and all that. So we'll see. It could change. But, these young people are on the left. They're not really on our side, in terms of having a racial cultural identity as white.
No. No, they revile that in all its forms. Yeah. Yeah. This is a strange thing. You've now got this phenomenon, which I guess has been the case at various points before, where it's the left that are being labelled anti-Semitic. It's the left that are opposing Jewish power in a public way.
Right.
And the right that are, obedient to it.
Yes, that's exactly right now.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. Just finally, what do you think the prospects are? And I know you're not a military strategist or whatever, but what do you think the prospects are of the conflict in Gaza spreading and in bringing in Jordan, Iran, Russia, China, and so on?
Well, there's certainly a threat there, but I don't see it really happening, frankly. Iran has expressed outrage about this. They've made statements, but I don't see them doing anything. And I do think, you know, Israel's armed to the teeth. They still have the total military backing of the United States, which is a superpower, genuine superpower, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons and all that, and all the latest weaponry from the West. I just don't think that it would be wise for these countries to do that. They're not in a really good position. Russia's bogged down in Ukraine now. They don't want to get involved with that. They're certainly not happy with what's going on. I don't think they support Israel and the UN on this, but I don't see it. Possibly. It's certainly more likely than in recent past, but not a big deal.
Okay. Well, there are a few super chats, and I know that you're not feeling terribly well, but would you mind answering some of those?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, just 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, here's the first one. This is Potato Mutt.
What?
Just his username, Potato Mutt. Okay, he says, it has been suggested that the K slur was coined by American Jews in the 1800s to deride Eastern European immigrant Jews of that time. So American Jews coined the K slur against Eastern European Jews. The slur that American Gentiles used at the time was Yid. Would this suggest that American Jews had nativist sensibilities, or that Jews could integrate into the West?
Well, you know, there's a whole story about Jewish activism to get Jews out of Eastern Europe and into the West, and especially America. And that's a time when there were all these stories of atrocities in Russia, especially in the Russian Empire. And a lot of them were exaggerated. Andrew Joyce has a number of articles on Axel Observer about the pogroms, so-called, in Eastern Europe at the time. And Jews, you know, making up stories of mass rape and all that. And they were then publicized in American newspapers and had an influence. And, you know... So, yeah, it has been going on, and Jewish, you know, ultimately you have to talk about Jewish activism and how intense they are. I wrote a paper just a while ago, it's an Oxfam Observer, and the title is Why Are Jews So Influential? And I talk about the psychology of it. I don't talk about our individualism as a problem, but I talk about, which it is, but I talk about Jewish activism and how to think about it, their ethnocentrism and their psychological intensity, their ability to cooperate in cohesive, effective groups, their intelligence and how well-funded their projects are. I mean, ADL has like $200 million a year budget, or that much donations, I guess, that in the recent financial statement. So it's a number of things, and there's a psychological intensity of Jewish activism. where, you know, any problem.
I read this essay. I remember that you talked about that as a character trait.
Yeah. It's a phenomenon.
Okay. Open Borders for Israel asks, would Kevin ever write an autobiography? Also, what was his time like in Jamaica as a jazz pianist? I didn't know you were a jazz pianist in Jamaica.
What's that word?
A jazz pianist in Jamaica.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I went to... I was part of the 60s. You know, I would turn on, tune in, drop out. Well, I dropped out. And I decided I wanted to be a musician. It was very much part of the 1960s culture. Jazz was in my little culture there in Madison. And I got into jazz. I still like it a lot. And I played, I played jazz piano. I'm in a group. And I very much enjoy that. I haven't really thought seriously about an autobiography. I think there'd be some interesting things that people don't know about me. But I haven't... You know, it's the kind of thing, you know, how much privacy do you want and all that, so.
Yeah, of course. I understand. Have any Jews contacted Kevin in private and said that they agree with him? I looked at the reviews of his first book, and it looked like a lot of the good reviews came from Jewish academics.
Rarely. And let me think, Jewish academics. I mean, there is some that are sort of on our side, like Paul Gottfried. Paul Gottfried has spoken at Jared Taylor's conferences and so on. And he's pretty good, but you know, he rejects some of my stuff. And so we've had, arguments, same with Lawrence Oster. He accepts a lot of it, but then disagrees with some of it, the important parts. And so, I haven't had much support. And I have had, you know, a few communications, but it really hasn't been substantial at all. It's been disappointing. And I've had very few critics who have really gone to any trouble to really write an in-depth criticism of me, except recently this guy Nathan Koffness has gone after me, and we've had this exchange back and forth for years, starting in 2018 and continuing. I published something at the beginning of 2023, but then it was retracted by this Jewish journal, Israeli journal. It was retracted under pressure. The editor was fired and all that, as I was defending my position. But anyway, haven't had a lot of support.
Right. Okay. Someone says, once you learn the percentage and positions and bankrollers of the Bolsheviks, and once you have read 200 Years Together and learned about the Holodomor, etc., you can never unsee who is maintaining the false narratives.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think that's critical. I mean, and Solzhenitsyn's book, 200 Years Together, very important. I have, you know, I've included a lot of that in my revision of Cultural Critique. There's a very important book, and it really talks about Jewish power in the Soviet Union in their 1920s, 1930s. And it's important to understand what happened in the Soviet Union. Because, again, I worry about that's the future of the West, that Jews, when they get to the point that white people have don't have enough power to stop it, just as the Russians did not have enough power to stop the Bolshevik government, you know, very horrible things, unimaginable things can happen. And these liberals in America and throughout the West, you know, have this idea that it's going to be a utopian society. No one's going to care about race. No one's going to care about anything. No, there's going to be hate. I see the hate against white people increasing, not decreasing. And
definitely. It's being stoked systematically.
So much. And it's encouraged from the highest points of our culture, the media. the academic world, you have all this hate against white people. And so it's not just some guy in the street, you know. It's people who are in prominent positions in the media, in the academic world, really espousing like anti-white hate and all this affirmative action, putting people in jobs that they're not qualified for, and all that that's going on now.
The hatred against white people that's encouraged is especially disgusting, because I really do think that most white people are just, they just really want to be good.
Yeah.
Especially the women. Like they just want to be good people.
They want to be good people and people to like them. That's a critical thing for white people's psychology, but especially women. The thought of being excluded because you're a bad person is just unthinkable for these people.
Yeah, it's unbearable. And so it's just the idea of demonizing these people, this type, this kind, I think is disgusting and evil. Spreading hatred off them and so on. It's repulsive. It's like taking the nicest, most kind kid at the party and encouraging all the other kids to hate on him. It's despicable.
Yeah.
All right. iHypocrite says, great guest. Thank you. Someone says, always lovely to hear Dr. McDonald and informative to read him. Any plans to collect some of your articles into a book or even a new project in mind?
Well, as I said, I'm revising Culture Critique. It's a big project. I have a lot more data on, say, Franz Boas and the Frankfurt School and other people like that. Somebody in Hungary sent me a whole trove of information, more recent stuff than I had in Culture Critique. I mean, it's been 25 years, so a lot of publications, a lot of stuff, things that are available online that were not online back in 1998. So there's just a whole, I mean, it's gotten to the point where you can't deny that this happened and that these activists were successful and their motivations and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I've been doing research as well recently, historical research, and it's astonishing how much is online. Fantastic. Okay. If it isn't improper to ask, do you have any opinion on the theory that Christianity was in part a group strategy to preserve Judaism and destroy Gentile pagan ways, centering European identity through their filter and always giving Jews an opportunity to hide in plain sight through conversion?
Yeah, I there's a well-known book by Scribina that I reviewed, and I'm certainly sympathetic to the idea, and it's been around a long time in other forms. But in my book, Separationist Contents, I think it's more complicated than that. I think it certainly started as an offshoot of Judaism, and it's conceivable that St. Paul had that motivation. But you can see an awful lot of anti-Jewish statements in the New Testament. But what happened is that in the fourth century, the Jews became very powerful in the Roman Empire, and they were enslaving Christians and wealthy. And so they were enslaving Christians and producing all this hatred. And so when Constantine converted and made the Christians the state religion, they went after the Jews. And there was all this anti-Semitism in the fourth century. And it continued. Now, it was never exterminatory. They didn't want to get this destroy the Jews. As this person noted, I mean, they wanted to keep them around as a testament to the truth of Christianity and that sort of thing. But there were other periods in church history that they really persecuted the Jews or gone after Jewish money lending and that sort of thing. If you ask Jewish activists about the history of the West, they hate the Catholic Church. And, there's a whole thing of Vatican II, where they reversed some of this stuff in the New Testament, where one of the verses is St. John or his, may his blood be on us and our descendants. And, you know, so blaming Jews for the murdering Christ became a big deal in Christianity. And there were all these passion parades in Germany and elsewhere. Celebrate, you know, not celebrating that fact, but noting that fact and, you know, hating the Jews for it. So it's always been a very fraught relationship. And they really changed it. And that's another result of Jewish activism, where Vatican II, there's a lot of pressure. We have a number of articles in Oxfam Observer about Jewish activism involved in changing traditional Catholic doctrines. I mean, if you look at the Catholic Encyclopedia from 1890 or something, and it had the traditional view of Judaism, that they had rejected Christ and that they were essentially evil in a variety of ways. I mean, it was, and that held true, it continued really until Vatican II in the early 1960s.
All right. Okay, Pure Nomad says, Kevin's a great guest, always puts more levels on the situation that we are facing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert says, thank you, Woz, for having Millennial this year and having Kevin MacDonald on. Really enjoy and appreciate the work both of you guys do. Keep up the good work that you do. Both of you guys, you both do good work.
thank you,
Robert. That's a very thorough compliment, and I appreciate it. Okay, and then Rick Shaw says, this has been a great year for mainstreaming our talking points. Here's to 2024 being the year that Elon acknowledges that Klaus Schwab is a Rothschild. Thank you, Rick. That's a reference to an in-joke that it was frustrating me that people thought Klaus Schwab was a Rothschild when it was a mistake.
Yeah, I don't know where you get that.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure he's Jewish.
I don't think he is, but who knows?
He was a protege of Henry Kissinger. And
yeah. The one that surprised me more was that Irish guy who died a couple of years ago. And apparently he wasn't Jewish, but he looked it, and he definitely said the stereotypical things that you would expect. Forgotten his name now, so it doesn't matter. Okay.
I know what you're talking about. By the way, speaking of Elon Musk, he banned me from Twitter a few months ago. So
yeah, I know, and that scuppered your tete-a-tete with Nathan Kaufness. It's a damn shame. I'm sorry that happened.
It's so hard to get the word out for us. I mean, that's the thing. Control.
This is what I experienced as well. When I got banned from Twitter, you can no longer respond to people. So they're free to say whatever they like about you. And your response is on your own website or on a different social media platform. And the people will never see it. That alone, I think, means that access to Twitter should be regarded as a sort of human right, because otherwise you're cutting people off from the ability to defend their own reputation.
Yeah, especially when they're well thought out and some serious effort and all that. But that's what they don't want. And there's still a lot of people that the ADL does not want on Twitter. But they got rid of me, James Edwards, Tom Sunich, and all these people. So I think they're going after the ones that they think are most influential or potentially influential, and leaving the rest.
Yes. Okay, Black Pigeon Pilled, do you think that Israel could sustain itself in the absence of American aid?
I think they could. If nothing else, the Jewish community would step up, and they can easily provide that kind of money. It's money in the bank, and certainly, it's better to have somebody else pay for other people's money. And right now they want us to pay for the war.
Yes, indeed. Someone pointed out the Irish guy that I was talking about. It was Peter Sutherland. Thank you for that. That was indeed who I was meaning. Okay, and JD, has Dr. McDonald heard anything from Andrew Joyce?
No, I haven't.
Right.
Okay. It's very disconcerting. Someone said that he'd been murdered, but I have no evidence of that.
Good God.
But it's concerning that he hasn't. I reached out to him a number of times. It's one thing if he's not able, he's too busy to write or something like that, that's fine. What I don't understand is why he wouldn't even say hi, or this is why I can't do anything now. I know he was going through some personal problems, a divorce or something like that, but I'm very concerned.
Right. Yeah. Was he living in Ireland or America?
Yeah, I think he wanted to come to America. His wife was American, but the British, I think at the behest of the American embassy, they prevented him from coming.
All right. Well, maybe we should organize. We should contact the Irish police to look into this. It does seem quite a serious situation.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, Black Pigeon Pill asks, what are Kevin's thoughts on Khazaria as the origin of the Ashkenazim?
I've written against that. I don't really see that. There's one population genetic study that suggests that, but I talked to an expert in population genetics. He didn't buy it. And it just doesn't seem plausible. I mean, Yiddish is an offshoot of German. And it's not based on some kind of Turkish language or anything. So I really don't think that that's what happened. They came up from the Roman Empire. They went down the Rhine, up the Rhine, and then they went over to Eastern Europe. The Ashkenazi. That's my story.
Right. Okay. Kit says, I heard Maureen Lipman claim that her ancestors fled pogroms in Krakow. There were never any pogroms in Krakow. Do you think they actually believe their own exaggerated and often fake stories of persecution?
Oh, absolutely they do. That's been common. And, you know, there's all this hot stuff about the Holocaust. You know, I'm not a Holocaust denier. There's certainly of murders of Jews, systematic perhaps, but you just have to assume at this point that that Jewish persecutions are exaggerated. There's so many examples of that. And Andrew Joyce has been one of the great researchers on that.
Well, indeed. And there was a George Galloway collected.
George Galloway, yeah.
A bunch of things here about the recent conflict, claims that the Israelis have made that have turned out to be false. I'll read it out here. The foul allegations of rape have been dropped by the Israeli government. The 40 beheaded babies has been downscaled to one dead baby, not beheaded, and killed by persons unknown. 2/3 of the Israelis killed on October 7th were military personnel. The killers of the remaining 1/3 are definitively revealed to have been in part the Israeli armed forces themselves. Those with influence who spread the propaganda to the contrary stand exposed as war criminals, and now much blood stains their character forever. There we go. There are just a lot of lies at the beginning, as I was saying last night with another guest. Okay, and then finally, there was one other, but okay. It feels like I am witnessing the downfall of Jewish power, as someone says. I do agree. I do think that this is a pivotal moment that we're living through just now. And it does feel like, I don't think, especially among the younger generations, I don't think that, I think that there's been a serious, severe blow to their credibility, but dealt by themselves, by Netanyahu. It's really incredible, and I don't think the consequences will be temporary. But anyway, all right. And then finally, someone says, I'd like to thank Kevin for enlightening me. Before I read The Culture of Critique, I was a philo-Semitic civic nationalist.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, all right. Well, we've gone longer than I'd intended to, and I know that you're not you're a bit poorly just now, so I'm sorry about that. But I did think there would be a lot of super chats, and there were. So, all right. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much for appearing. Yeah. I'll be back in about 20 minutes with No Chance. But Kevin McDonald, is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
That's about it. I think we covered pretty much everything in my interest.
All right. Excellent. Well, this has been great. And I'm glad that we've finally arranged this and had you on Millennial. So
yeah, I hope you don't have any negative repercussions of this.
So do I. There's not much else I can say. I hope that I don't end up in jail for this, but I don't think I will. I think we kept it reasonable and civil and
yeah, polite. I mean, exactly. Yeah. And we're not saying all Jews or all Israelis. You know, we're not doing that. You know, but we are talking about Jewish power, where it's deployed and where it's been successful.
Yeah, and the thing is that every group is going to have power. So to talk of Jewish power shouldn't be seen as egregious. Every group naturally has some amount of power.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And every group acts in its own interests. Well, if it's sane, it does. So again, it's not something bizarre. It's just objectionable some of the ways in which they do it. Let's put it that way. All right. Okay. Well, Kevin McDonald, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Excellent. I'll be back soon. See you all then. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.